From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. When American gymnast Paul Hamm went from 12th to 4th to 1st in the men's all-around competition last Wednesday, he was a gold medal hero. Now, with the results in dispute and the South Koreans claiming they deserve the gold, Hamm is still a hero to some, but he's also at the center of Olympic controversy. The International Olympic Committee says the results, tainted as they are by judging errors, will stand. But sports commentators around the world are calling on Hamm to give back the medal. The leadership of USA Gymnastics is somewhere in the middle. Tonight on Point, the gymnastics scoring scandal and the state of Olympic sportsmanship. We start in Athens, Greece, where Newsweek national sports correspondent Mark Starr has been following the controversy. I asked him whether the decision to give back the medal would be left up to Paul Hamm.
You know, I don't think it's going to come from Paul Hamm. We expect so much from these kids. He's only 21. He's competed under the most difficult circumstances. I don't think it's incumbent upon him to make a decision to share something that really is outside the rules. I think if it comes, it's going to come between the American officials and the Korean officials getting together and making some deal. But for Paul Hamm to have the burden of this, I think it's very unfair and it expects too much of him.
Well, walk us through some of this. I mean, how did this even end up as something that Paul Hamm could decide? Why wasn't the judging on the parallel bars fixed when it should have been?
Well, in truth, I'm not even sure Paul Hamm has the power to decide. From a public relations vantage point, he probably does, but he doesn't control this. Federation controls it. How did it happen? You know, our expectations are a bit unreal here. I mean, we're a country that can't run an election in Florida and get the machines to work. Suddenly we expect some sporting event to have perfect judging of a subjective sport. This stuff happens all the time, and what really shouldn't have happened is it shouldn't have come to light. Because, in truth, if they want to go back and look at videotape of every single one of the performers and every one of their performances, I assume they'll find other mistakes. This doesn't happen in a void. The other thing that's strange to me, you know, is that if they made the right decision at the time, it doesn't guarantee things would have come out the other way. Because if a man goes to the last event leading, sometimes emotionally he's different.
Right.
He's more nervous. It puts pressure on him. You know, you can't say things would have turned out exactly the same if they got it right. It's just like taking a soccer game that was scoreless and then determining that someone wasn't offsides and the game should have ended 1-0, as if the play wouldn't have been different if they allowed the goal in the 40th minute.
Right.
It's just unrealistic.
And that's the argument that this all has to happen in real time or it isn't going to have an effect. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, though, Paul Hamm has been somewhat constrained, or felt he was, in what he could say about this. I understand he wanted to hold a press conference. He wanted to release a statement and was discouraged from doing so by the president of USA Gymnastics. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, as usual, bureaucracies, when left on their own, don't do a very good job. I think it would have been very good early to get Paul out to express his feelings, to say how he feels, to say he was felt for the Korean situation, but there are rules in our sport, and I've competed under those rules all along. And they were too nervous to let him go forward. You know, it was sort of the idea, we've got it, we better not say anything, the burden's on the other team.
Well, Paul Hamm himself has raised the possibility that he was being played a bit here by USA Gymnastics because he and his twin brother have chosen to do a different tour than the one USA Gymnastics was planning for after the Olympics, and that somehow this was payback for making that decision. What do you think of that?
You know, paranoia is running rampant at these games. Paul should never have been put in this situation. As I say, the fact that these people come out and compete at such a high level, it should never be the athlete injected into bureaucracy. And the problem is we're comparing this to Salt Lake. I mean, that's really the beginning of all this. And that was a judging conspiracy. A very different thing than Aiden Burton error. One of the most famous plays in recent American sports history was the Women's World Cup against China.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody who was there, including myself, knows that our goalkeeper, Brianna Scurry, cheated a little off the line on our big save in the overtime. Now, why don't we go back to the videotape, take that game back to 0-0, and play it again? I mean, these are human judges, human sports. When it's a conspiracy, it's one thing. When it's an accident, sometimes you have to live with it.
Do you see any kind of a ripple effect, though, for the state of judging in gymnastics? I mean, there were three judges who were dismissed over that event at the parallel bars.
You know, I just watched Rulon Gardner wrestle and win the bronze medal. And all of these sports are using more and more technology. They sit there and they stop the match sometimes when the hands break to try and determine who broke the hand. Figure skating, which of course had the biggest controversy of all, is trying, you'll be amused by this, to turn its judging more into gymnastics-like. I mean, gymnastics was really the model for figure skating. Very technical. They make a lot of errors. And as I'm sure you've heard, one of the feelings is they made two errors on the Korean score. One by not giving them the full start value, which would have given them an extra tenth of a point, mm-hmm. and one for not punishing them for four holds on the bar, which would have taken 0.2 away. Where do you stop this? When the U.S. men's team, after they got the silver, several of them complained about their start value assignments, too. But we didn't hear anything about looking at videotape.
Well, what's likely to happen with this after the Olympics then? Is this something you think the IOC itself might get involved in? Generally, this is left to the federations of sports themselves.
Yeah, I think the IOC has been conspicuously silent on this. Jacques Rogge, you know, negotiated the deal in Salt Lake City between the Russians and the Canadians because it was such a mess in his sort of Olympic, you know, beginning that I think he wanted to settle it out. This really isn't a scandal. It's just a difficult and awkward situation. But referees' calls have affected all kinds of Olympics. Any American who is old enough, and that probably doesn't include you, but sadly it includes me.
Thank you, Mark.
Remembers the horrendous call that the Soviet Union got against the American basketball team that was in Munich in 1972. Mm-hmm. It was a horrendous call. You know, and some people are angry about it today. They're not giving back the medal. These things happen.
Mark Starr, thank you for joining us this evening.
Okay. My pleasure, Jennifer.
Mark Starr is the national sports correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Athens. Most Olympic watchers take for granted the human element in judging certain Olympic sports, the solidity of a gymnast's landing. Did they stick it? The graceful arc of a diver's back. These are things the thinking goes that cannot be measured by a machine. But a century ago, it wasn't just gymnastics and diving that were judged by human beings. Nearly every Olympic sport, from running to swimming to fencing, was subject to human interpretation. Meredith May, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, has written about the history of Olympic judging. I asked her how the 100-meter race was judged in the 1932 Olympic Games.
That was judged by about 25 men with stopwatches. And so they all had their thumb on the trigger, so to speak, and they all took a time and then looked down at what everybody wrote and kind of took the best test or averaged it out,
yeah.
Basically.
Triangulated the truth from all the results of the stopwatch.
Right, right.
To the point in 2004 that now we have cameras that shoot how fast?
They shoot 1,000 pictures per second. But the cool thing is they only focus on the first 8 millimeters of the finish line. So it's in that little space that the flashes start happening.
It really is in the width of a hair almost that you win and lose some of these races. Your article that you wrote in the San Francisco Chronicle, you took a look at the introduction of technology for scoring and timing a lot of these Olympic events. And one of the points that you make, which is really interesting, is that it was not all that welcomed by some of the athletes. Tell me about what happened in the pool.
Oh, that was the first time that they put touch pads in the swimming pool, and that was the Commonwealth Games. And that, I believe, was 1972. But what happened was... It was in Australia, and the Australian team was disqualified a handful of times for leaving the start box too fast. And they were so outraged, and, you know, they didn't trust the new equipment that they were really literally throwing chairs at the officials. And Peter Hertzler, now the vice president of Swiss Timing, who introduced the new technology, he tells a story about walking home from the pool with the officials, and someone literally tried to swerve into them with their car.
They were that unpopular at those Commonwealth Games.
Oh, yeah, and he was actually telling the story, and he was visibly upset. I mean, he was saying that they had to, in the middle of the night, with guards, change their hotel room because they were worried about their safety.
One of the things about the pool, too, it's not just the touchpad, which I think all of us have learned to appreciate as we watch these races, and it looks to our own human eyes as if everyone came in first. The touchpad under the water that registers who came in first, but those starting blocks also measure things for the relays as well?
Right. I didn't know that either, but the starting block, the whole block itself is like a sensitive instrument, and so it feels when the swimmer's feet leave. For two reasons, you need a point in time to start counting, and then it also can tell in relays if the second and third and fourth person, if they leave before the swimmer has touched the touch pad under the water.
When I read that in your article, I thought a lot of these athletes, as pushed as they are to get off the block fast, it must make them hesitate a bit, because what we see with our human eye and what that touchpad can measure now, you have to play it on the side of safety, don't you?
Yeah, I think athletes had to change their game, and I think in the case of swimming, that the uproar at the Brisbane Commonwealth Games was that maybe the Australians were getting a little bit of an edge by leaving faster than the naked eye, but you couldn't tell.
Did you see any possibility for making some of the more subjectively judged games at the Olympics more objectively judged by technology?
Wow. Actually, the first one that comes to mind for me is water polo. I think it'd be very simple to stick a camera under the water where a lot of the fouls happen. And it might be easier for the referees on the sides who are blowing the whistles, because water polo is crazy. It's like basketball, soccer, and mugging together. There are so many fouls that you can't even tell are happening, and I seriously don't know why there's not a camera down there. So that's the first one.
There are a lot of other sports that probably have more technology involved with them than we're even aware of. Tell us about the runners and the bicyclists and even kayakers. What have they got going technology-wise?
Marathon runners have microchips in their shoes, and so every 5 kilometers, they go by a sensor that picks it up and records their time, although they still use manual backup. They have people with clipboards and pencils who are recording when the runners go by.
And so not that this would be possible, but I suppose that would prevent anyone from taking a subway for part of the route, which has happened in non-Olympic marathons before.
I asked that same question. I said, is it also a backup for cheating? And Peter Hertzler from Swiss Timing just laughed, and he said, you really can't cheat at the Olympics because there's so much media that the minute you went down the wrong street, you'd be recorded. But he said in other venues or in other competitions that don't have this much attention, it does work for that too.
And the same sort of system in place for bicyclists?
A very similar system is in place for road cycling. The only difference is instead of being passive, like passing over an antenna that records your time, cyclists have transmitters that they clip onto the spokes of their wheels, which send signals back to antennas, which pick them up.
We talked about Peter Hertzler with Swiss Timing being so unpopular at those Commonwealth Games more than 20 years ago now. How is he viewed by the athletes today?
He's the man now. he walks into a room and everyone comes up and shakes his hand. He loves being around the athletes. He wanted to be a hockey player as a little boy himself. And, for him, this is the next best thing.
Thank you for joining us tonight, Meredith.
You're welcome.
Meredith May is a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. She spoke with me from Athens. We're talking tonight about judging and the state of Olympic sportsmanship. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the Olympic scoring scandal and the state of Olympic sportsmanship. Is it fair that Paul Hamm is left to decide what he wants to do with his medal? Are the International Olympic Committee and the International Gymnastics Federation abdicating their responsibility, or are they simply playing by the rules? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from University Park, Pennsylvania, is Mark Dyerson, Associate Professor of Kinesiology and History at Penn State University and author of Making the American Team, Sport, Culture, and the Olympic Experience. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
And joining us from Boston, Massachusetts, is Peter Roby, Director of Northeastern University's Center for the Study of Sport in Society. Good evening, Peter.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
I'd like to ask both of you before we begin your opinion of the position Paul Hamm finds himself in. If I can start with you, Mark, is it fair, do you think, to expect an athlete to be the one who decides who does and doesn't get to share the gold?
I don't know if it's fair, but if I were his agent, I'd tell him he had a great opportunity here to be Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year by sharing the medal with the Korean athlete, because whether it's fair or not, we want athletes at the Olympic Games for some reason to rise to a sort of higher standard. So if I was his agent, I would tell him there is an immense amount of money in at least pretending to be a great sport in this case and sharing the medal.
How about you, Peter? How do you feel about it?
Well, I think they've put him in a tough spot, and I don't think
it's fair.
Yeah, I don't think it's fair for them to ask him to make that decision. That's up to the governing bodies and the officials that are supposed to be doing those types of things to have rules in place that anticipate those kinds of issues and when they happen to rule on them. And the fact that they haven't come out and said strongly enough that it is what it is and whether there was human error or not, we have to live with it, is disappointing.
Do you think he has anything to lose, though, if he does decide, and there's no indication that he's going to do this, if he does decide to share or somehow give away a medal, is there a downside to that in terms of popularity for him?
Not at all. I mean,
as
Mark said, I think he stands to gain quite a bit in terms of public perception and in terms of the Olympic ideal for him to make that kind of unselfish gesture. But, you know, you're making someone have to make an awful tough decision after they've worked most of their adult life to put themselves in a position to be able to stand on the medal stand and win a gold medal for their country. So, you know, you'd like to think that the rules and the mechanisms in place would keep an athlete from having to be put in that situation.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about rules here, but I have to say, as a watcher of the Olympics this week, these rules sometimes seem to come and go. There was an instance this week where everything stopped still in the arena where the gymnastics competition was going on because the crowd was booing a score for close to 10 minutes that Russian Alexei Nemov got on the high bar, and his score was changed. So do we really say that people are abiding by the rules when something like that can happen, Mark?
I mean, I think what the Olympic Games do is open up this window for us to see how people behave in very stressful situations, whether they adhere to the spirit of the rules and the sort of spirit of sportsmanship, whatever that is, or to the letter of the law, whether winning is everything or you take a sort of different route. There are certainly precedents in Olympic history for changing scores. There was a Norwegian-born American ski jumper in 1924 in the 90-meter ski jump who finished fourth. And decades later, a ski historian found out they did the scoring wrong. They added a score wrong, and he deserved actually the bronze medal to finish third. And the IOC, in that case, 50 years after the fact, awarded a bronze medal. They didn't take the bronze medal away from the person who had finished third originally, but they did award a bronze medal to a guy named Anders Hagen. So I do think there is some problem with the bureaucracy here not ponying up in the way they should.
Well, you might want to write a memo. I didn't even know that precedent existed. I'm wondering, too, was the recipient of the second bronze medal alive at that point to receive it? Do you know?
He was 83 years old and alive, so they managed to do it in his lifetime. Jim Thorpe, they restored his medals, but he had passed away by that time.
For goodness sake.
Sometimes it's posthumous.
For goodness sake. So, you know, there might still be some hope for this Korean who's wanting some sort of a boost. He's got a bronze medal already.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's thinking he should have something that's a little more colorful. You made a comment there, Mark, about what is sportsmanship. It sounded a little cynical. What did you mean by that vis-a-vis the Olympic Games?
Well, the Olympic Games certainly market themselves as a purer form of sport than, say, the National Football League or Major League Baseball, sort of uncorrupt and pure, even though we've dispensed with the whole myth of the amateur. And so I think the International Olympic Committee and the Olympic movement make a lot of money and certainly garner a lot of public attention because they claim to hold to this higher standard, you know, the Olympic motto that it's not the winning but the taking part. And so it is disappointing to see when the international federations and the Olympic Committee don't live up to their own motto in a case like this and figure out how to reward the Korean while not punishing Paul Han.
You know, the other thing, too, is sometimes, like we're talking about Paul Han and what he could or could not do here, but sometimes, too, it is the athletes that set the standard for us and remind us what the games are all about. I'm thinking about, I was watching last night the last event in the decathlon. Did either of you see this?
Yeah.
Yes.
That was great.
I thought when it first began, I was watching the end of it because it was kind of a mob scene on the track and they were all patting each other on the back and shaking hands and they do this before every event in the decathlon, not at the end of it.
Yeah, it was a wonderful scene, and I think it's indicative of just how much agony and pain they go through to compete in the 2 days of the decathlon, and I think they have a real mutual respect for each other, knowing what it takes to be at that level, to be that proficient in that many events. And it did sort of bring out the best in the Olympic spirit, and I thought the other was the Moroccan runner winning the 1500 last night and embracing his competitor who pushed him to the end and he nipped him at the wire, and then embracing him and breaking down and crying because he had worked so hard to ultimately achieve that goal and had missed twice in the last two Olympics. And it was a wonderful scene, and that's really what we try to promote at Sport and Society, is the power of sport and how it can be that great common denominator that brings people from all types of cultures and backgrounds together under a common umbrella. And that's what the Olympic Games really are supposed to be about. It's unfortunate when the controversies come up, whether it's about drug testing and doping or about judging errors, that it does take away from that ideal. But the wonderful thing about it is that the athletes, for the most part, always seem to rise above that.
Peter, do you see this controversy that's embroiling gymnast Paul Han as different than the controversy in Salt Lake City with the figure skaters?
No question.
And what is the difference in your mind?
Oh, well, there was incredible pressure and intimidation brought to bear on the judge from France to change her score or to favor one pair over the other. So there was a conscious effort on someone's part to manipulate the outcome, whereas in the case of what happened with Paul Han, it was, at least from all accounts, it was an honest error in judgment or someone's opinion that the score should be what it was, but in no way was done with any malice. I think there's a big difference.
Do you think there'll be a difference in terms of how judging is done? I know neither of you are gymnastics experts, but I'm curious about how the controversy might prompt change, whether this is the kind of thing that happens over something every Olympic Games we have, or whether this is different.
Well, one of the interesting things that based on what I know of the situation, is that there was a time frame by which the appeal needed to be made, and it wasn't adhered to. They had missed the appeal process, the time in which the appeal was going to be valid. And so in some ways, the federation or the judges had no choice. Unlike what happened in the swimming pool, when Pearsall was judged to have been disqualified, and within a matter of minutes, they reversed it because they saw that there was no validity to the claim. And it was within a time frame that they've obviously set up. So
yeah, but you know what was different about that is he was disqualified, and it got everybody's attention right away.
Right, but they had a mechanism in place to review it. There's
right.
a committee that once that sort of a situation is declared, they have a chance to review it and have a process in place that they were anticipating those things can happen, and it was then reversed, which is within the grounds and bounds of what they're able to do. And I think the same is true with regard to the judging in the gymnastics situation. They had a mechanism in place for appeals to be made, and they didn't do it in a timely fashion. So, you know, it is unfortunate, but if you don't have any kind of ground rules, then you can have chaos.
Okay. I'd like to bring the callers into the conversation here. From Johnston, Rhode Island, Lazra, you're on point. Welcome.
Hi. I just want to say, I mean, I watch the Olympics every day. And honestly, from when I was a kid and watched the Olympics, it's just missing. It's starting to lose the aura. I mean, these people work so hard, you know, to achieve, you know, the goals they set for themselves to get to the Olympics, just to figure out that I really won, but I'm not going to be given a medal because somebody didn't do something in a timely fashion. I mean, I think if they're going to be judging, going to be putting people in a position to judge others, they should really have a lot of backup mechanisms to make sure such mistakes are not made.
Yeah, you'd like to think so, and I'm sure Paul Hamm would join you in that sentiment. Thank you, Lazra. We're joined now by Miles Avery. He's Paul Hamm's gymnastics coach. He's been assistant coach to the 2004 Men's U.S. Gymnastics Olympic Team and Ohio State Men's Gymnastics head coach. Welcome, Miles.
Thank you. Thank you.
I understand that Paul Hamm has been on TV this morning. He's scheduled to make an appearance on David Letterman later this evening. Is he anxious to talk about this?
Yes, he is. Obviously, you know, he hopes that, you know, America is proud of what he's done and really have everyone understand, you know, the totality of everything that evening and that why he really does deserve, you know, his medal in the course of a competition. You know, sometimes reps do get a call bad or not, and it could go against you, it could go for you. But in the course of the whole competition, that he really did deserve to win his gold medal.
How's he feeling right now?
Kind of on an island, like, you know, just people, obviously, that work with him every day, that not everyone is for him, because some people only have some of the information about what happened there that night. And that people are against him. Oh, you should give your medal back. You should really support a double gold. When we reviewed the tape, you know, he said, well, there's, you know, other things that if they are going to review the tape that everyone should have talked about. And I think maybe even the Koreans would have said, well, that is correct. If you're going to review it and you see it one way, you need to see it the other side of that too, which could be negative for everyone. And if the officials that evening had got everything right on the field of play, then the Korean would have actually been fourth, not even third. I mean, he got a medal at being third only because the officials missed something else as well. And NBC tried to bring that out yesterday or two nights ago, showing the American public where, you know, they do miss things, and they missed two things in that particular routine.
Yeah, I did catch that segment. We mentioned earlier in the program as well that Paul himself had wanted to release a statement. He'd also wanted to hold a press conference and was discouraged from doing so by USA Gymnastics. And I'm wondering what you think was at work there.
Well, I don't know, and I don't want to, you know, guess, as people often do, that anything sinister was behind it. But I think, and I wish at this point in time, that he had done that, and he did you know, have that press conference to explain himself, as hopefully David Letterman tonight gives him an opportunity to do that.
What changes do you think need to happen in judging? Are there any? There were some changes in Salt Lake City, to figure skating after the Salt Lake City scandal. Is there any change they can make in gymnastics?
Well, I think as long as you do have humans sitting in those chairs, just like refs running on the field, that they can get calls right or wrong. I don't know what changed. Obviously, we think that we have the best officials in the world sitting in those chairs for something like an Olympics. But they still are human. But at least in gymnastics, there is a mechanism in place to rectify something. If I think my athlete start value, so to speak, isn't correct, then I inquire about that as to why it wasn't. And I think just in the heat of competition at that point in time, the Koreans didn't realize that, and it wasn't until the next day that they said, well, hey, you know, why didn't our guy start from a 10.0, which he certainly should have. But the refs got it wrong that evening on the field of play, and we just can't go back and review the tapes the next day to say a ref made a bad call. We should have won the game.
I'd like to bring some more callers into the conversation. Miles, can you stay with us for a bit?
I sure can.
Okay. Robert is calling from Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. You're on Point, Robert. Welcome.
Good evening. I was originally calling to make the point that Mr. Avery just made, that the that the video review would have actually taken the South Korean off the medal podium. But the larger point is that that's why there is no video review in gymnastics. Just today, my beloved Milwaukee Brewers lost a game based on a very horrible call in the bottom of the ninth, but there's no video review in baseball. So I guess just the final thing I would need to say is, being from Wisconsin, as Paul Hamm
is. As is Paul Hamm, right?
We around here are still deeply proud of him, and you, Mr. Avery.
He would appreciate that. Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's been a comment made, Miles, that that Paul Hamm would be even more the hero if he did do something like share his medal. How do you feel about that?
Well, certainly, and myself, after looking at the videotape, and say, well, these officials really messed this one up. And if I thought, or even Paul thought, that he didn't deserve that because he did something wrong, or the officials cheated, or anything like that, I think he would and should give the medal back, because he would not be worthy of that. But that isn't the situation here. Again, if they had gotten it right on the floor, as I've told Paul, he still would have been champion, and Yang Taeyang would not have even been on the podium if the officials had gotten it right on the floor. So I don't understand the call for him to give it back, when, again, he would have still won the championship had the officials gotten it right on the floor.
Yeah, and you see, that point that you're making, I don't think is out there as widely as some of the other facts about this case, because the argument that you're making is it just wasn't a matter of scoring errors. There were some other things that happened in the Koreans' routine that, if taken into account, would have led to a lower score. Am I understanding
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That is correct.
And how much of a factor is it that this happened not on the final event in the all-around? Like, if this had been, if this might not have affected anyone's mindset going into another stage of the competition, would it make a difference?
Well, I think if it were on the last event, then there is no room for improvement. As Paul's error happened on the fourth event, there are two events left. You know, and no one, again, at the time as the competition is going on, no one realized that error happened with the officials. And we all go into the last event, we look up at the scoreboard, and you see what you need. Well, we knew at that point Paul needed a 9-8 something, and he went out and he did that. Well, even if that error wasn't made, let's say, and Yang Taeyang had a tenth more, well, hey, Paul, you need to do your best routine of your life. You need a 9-9 to win. That's what I would have been told him. But what I told him is, hey, you need a 9-8 to get this done and just achieve a medal at that point in time.
And there you go. Athletes, Miles.
Athletes rise to the occasion all the time.
And he did. Miles, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me, absolutely.
Miles Avery is Paul Hamm's gymnastics coach and assistant coach to the 2004 Men's U.S. Gymnastics Olympic team. We're talking tonight about the gymnastics scoring controversy and Olympic sportsmanship. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Olympic scandals and Olympic sportsmanship. I'm talking with Mark Dyerson, Associate Professor of Kinesiology and History at Penn State University, and author of Making the American Team, Sport, Culture, and the Olympic Experience. Also with us is Peter Roby, Director of Northeastern University's Center for the Study of Sport in Society. Well, our phone lines are ringing, so I'd like to bring some more callers back into the conversation. Rob, you're calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi. I guess I've got a slightly different perspective on this. I'm an Olympic-level official in luge, and I've worked at world championships and world cup races, and I don't know anything about the rules of gymnastics beyond what I've seen in the paper, but it occurs to me that if there's a villain in this story, it's not Paul Hamm, it's not the judges who made a simple error. The Korean athlete was let down by his coaches, who didn't see that there was an error and didn't protest it in a timely manner. The coaches should know the rules and regulations as well as a judge. I don't understand why more hasn't been made about this, that they waited 2 days to raise this issue instead of immediately at the point where it occurred.
It's interesting, the point that you raise. I mean, is that your expectation as a judge at the Olympic level, that if there's a problem, you need to hear about it right away, or it just isn't a factor?
Yeah, in our sport, there is a limit on when a protest can be filed. They have roughly 15 minutes after the event is over, and you have to file, at least in international competitions, you have to have a protest fee of 50 euros. But if you have a protest, you have 15 minutes after the conclusion of the event to file your protest, and a jury considers whether it's legitimate. And there have been plenty of cases where an athlete was able to establish that they were fouled on the run, a spectator threw a snowball at them or something, and they get a do-over on that run.
That's an interesting point, Rob. Thank you. Mark, if I can turn that over to you, there hasn't been a lot of talk about whether the Koreans, the coaching staff on the Korean team is in fact at fault. Why did it all turn so much on Paul Hamm, do you think?
I think the way the media has driven the story...
It's our fault. I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, it's always the media's fault, isn't it, if it's not an academic's fault? But the way the story's been driven, you know, we do like, the public and the media, we do like good guys and bad guys in a fairly simple and clean story. And I agree with you when you were talking to his coach earlier that it really hasn't been brought out the complexities of the judging and that there were other things going on. What we've heard in the public is only that there was a mistake and the Korean actually would have won the medal, a more simple version of the story. But I agree with the point that the South Korean coach has probably made a fundamental mistake here. But it's one of those things where we don't want there to be a mistake, and we wish that people would rise to the angels of their better nature and say, even though technically by the rules I won, I apparently Paul Hahn doesn't feel this way in this case, but I realize there was a mistake and I want to share the medal or give it back or whatever. That's, I think, what a lot of us would hope to see athletes sometimes do.
Well,
I just don't see how that is up to Paul Hahn. I mean, how can an athlete decide that he's going to share his medal? I mean, his job is to go out and participate to the best of his ability as fairly and as honestly as he can. That's up to the IOC and the governing bodies to decide if anybody else is going to share it, like in the case of the Canadians and the Russians in Salt Lake. But it's certainly not up to Paul Hamm or any other individual athlete to say that, well, since they won't step up, let me do it. I mean, I wouldn't imagine that if he did do that, that the governing bodies or the IOC would accept it, because it's not something that's supposed to be done on the part of the athlete. That's up to the governing bodies and the officials to do that.
I'd like to bring another caller in, Tara from Acton, Massachusetts. You have an opinion on just this point. Welcome.
Hi. I'm wondering why it seems as though people think in terms of Paul being punished by sharing. I think sharing is a wonderful thing. I don't really understand why they can't share, and you think, well, then it'll dilute the importance of the medal, but there's so many events to begin with, it makes your head spin. I mean, in the old days, there was just one swimming medal, that was it. But I think in terms of the journey, and if you're not there for the journey, if it's all about whether you got it or you didn't get it, then we're teaching a whole generation of kids that it's all about just the win. It has nothing to do about the process.
What do you think there, Mark? Isn't it all about the win, in fact?
Well, I think that's the problem, or that's the paradox, that it is partly all about the win, and we would also like to see some other things going on. And I certainly agree that technically it's not up to Paul Hahn doing it and giving it back or sharing it. It would probably throw a monkey wrench into the rings. But I think you get in a situation like the famous five-down situation when Bill McCartney, the coach of the Colorado football team, basically they saw the review and Colorado got five downs, but Colorado won anyway and said, well, you know, that's tough. That's part of the game. We're not going to give the win back. There's a parallel. In the 1940s, Dartmouth was in the same position and actually gave the win back, even though the NCAA didn't make them. So sometimes, even though you don't have to and you're not ethically or technically required to step up, right, it's the right thing to do. Now, in this case, it appears that Paul Hahn thinks he competed fairly and within the rules and still won. It would be a different issue, I suppose, if he thought he benefited from an error and he might make a different decision. So we should make that distinction. But sometimes you should Sometimes the athlete does have to step up because everybody else has fallen down.
Well, I was reading today about a competitor at the Trampoline World Championships not that long ago who did win overall and outright, but because of a scoring error. And it was her that went to the judges in the federation and said, I think that this should be fixed. But again, we're talking about how simple or how not simple the story of Paul Hamm's win is. And I think in that case, it was probably a little simpler case of right and wrong. I'm going to try and squeeze in one last call here. Josh, you're calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Briefly here. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I'm not quite understanding how different this is than a major sporting event like, the World Series or the Super Bowl or even a World Cup soccer game. It's a matter of, okay, so the last play of the game that was actually offsides that was for soccer, I'm saying. There was offsides that ended up allowing a team to score the winning goal. I mean, do they take a look at it 2 days later and say, hey, look, this isn't right? So then they all of a sudden take that win away and give it to the other team?
No, they don't.
I just don't understand how that's different now. And the unfortunate thing is that Paul Hamm is stuck in the middle of it, and it's now his decision to do right or wrong. And it's just like it should have been up to the governing bodies of the Olympics and not just put on Paul's shoulders, because he's kind of in a catch-22, does he do it for PR or does he do it because that's really what he thinks he should do, so.
Okay, thank you there, Josh. Mark, just a very quick comment from you. Do you think what happened in Salt Lake City is what has led some sort of expectation that we can change results at Olympics?
I think that might be driving part of it, but we have these controversies about judging at every Olympic Games and in a whole variety of sports, the supposedly objective as well as the more subjectively scored ones as well.
Thank you, Mark. That's all the time that we have for tonight, and I would like to thank you both for joining us in the conversation. Mark Dyerson, Associate Professor of Kinesiology and History at Penn State University, thank you.
Thank you.
And Peter Roby, Director of Northeastern University's Center for the Study of Sport in Society. Thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thank you, Jen.
You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a fictional look at the making of an Olympic moment. I'm Jennifer Westaway. You're listening to On Point. Olympics judging may be in dispute, but the TV ratings are pure gold for NBC. Last week, when gymnast Carly Peterson became the first American woman to win the all-round since Mary Lou Retton in 1984, viewership topped 31 million. But between the events and races, NBC is churning out a constant stream of packaged Olympic moments, the personal stories of athletes that are designed to pull hard at the heartstrings, heavy on emotion and hype. Writer John Kenny imagines just how these television moments might be created behind the scenes. This fictional scene opens with a producer, writer, and researcher reading through a file of athlete biographies at the Olympic Broadcasting Center in Athens.
So, who's next?
Let's see, a Romanian swimmer.
Okay, what can we do with him?
Is his mother alive?
Yes, she is. Why?
Too bad.
Any family history of illness?
It says here that his aunt had shingles once.
This could be good.
This could be very good. Were they close?
He only met her once. Apparently, she was insane. Claimed she was a porpoise.
I like this. One meeting with her is all it took.
What are you talking about?
A profound meeting. Life-altering. Spurred him to greatness.
He has a picture of her.
There's no mention of that here.
In his mind.
He sees her face when he runs.
He's a swimmer.
Even better. She gave him his first bathing suit.
Where are you coming up with this? He was 2 years old when he met her, and he didn't start competing until he was 15. She was in an asylum.
The connection's there. Can't you see it?
I see it. His healthy mother still remembers the meeting. The child glowed.
But in the intervening years, bad things happened. Communist repression. His aunt thinks he's Flipper.
The boy loves his trunks from his aunt. What boy doesn't love his swim trunks?
He swims for his aunt. The aunt who can't swim. Don't you see? This is his mission. He loves her still.
Yes! Of course he does. Perhaps she's terminal.
I love it. Write it. I'll book a crew. Who's next?
A Belgian cyclist.
Belgium.
It's cold in Belgium.
It is?
Often. So he rides at night.
Why would he ride his bike at night? That would be insane. Do you know how fast
Shh.
They...
Go on.
His bike is old. It's not a new bike. The bike was a gift from his mother, a charwoman.
Yes, she's a charwoman. I like the word charwoman. Poor. There's no money. But he loves the sport too much to stop. He rides at night, waits for her to come home from cleaning.
He fashions a new bike from wood. He's poor, you see?
What on earth? This guy's a professional. He's sponsored by Nike. He started his own software company. He's a billionaire.
I once read of a child who needed a kidney.
What?
Be quiet.
The boy was ill. From Chicago, I believe.
Bosnia.
Better. There was a war, winter, frozen mud, dysentery.
The boy.
Orphan.
Beautiful. The orphan lay near death. He needed a kidney.
But what does this have to do with...
Someone must give him one.
Someone must sacrifice an organ for the orphan.
Please tell me what this has to do with...
The Norwegian skeet shooter.
He's a Belgian cyclist.
Sure. He saw the story.
What story?
It touched home.
He's never forgotten it.
Who could forget? He rides for the boy.
I love it. Write it. We've got a crew in Prague now. Who's next?
The Nigerian fencer.
My God. This is a dream come true. Where is Nigeria?
Near Belgium.
Africa, on the west coast.
Do you know what I think?
Tell me.
I think he's gay.
Fantastic. A gay Belgian gymnast.
Nigerian fencer, and he's married with three children.
No matter. Lifelong dream to fence in the Olympics.
Swords, foils, épées. Marvelous words. First time on a plane, probably.
What? He's a pilot! He went to Stanford!
Stanford, of course. Don't you see? It's so obvious.
What?
Tell him.
He could have stayed in the West, but he went back to his village after college in America to help the starving children.
He saved many of them, operated on them in the night. He's a doctor, practiced fencing with a broomstick.
He's not a doctor. He works on Wall Street.
Of course he does. All the better.
What are you talking about?
His one chance for redemption.
For the little boy he lost.
What boy?
There was a boy. He lost him. On the operating table.
He's not a doctor.
Perhaps he knows first aid.
He sure well better know first aid if he's going to be operating on poor little children in chairs.
Nigeria!
You're missing the point. The boy died. Now he swims for the boy.
He's a fencer!
Can we make him a swimmer? Ask him if he'd like to swim instead. Who's next?
Writer John Kenny lives in Paris. His op-ed, And Now Another Olympic Moment, appeared in today's New York Times. Read tonight by Meghna Chakrabarty, Sean Cole, and Chris O'Connor. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Rachel Dornhelm, Odette Youssef, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.